to each according to his need. When humans invented material inequality, they came up with a way of subjugating the low ranking like nothing ever before seen in the primate world. A really odd thing that we do now and then. Amid the unique features of human hierarchies, one of the most distinctive and recent is this business of having leaders and choosing who they are. As discussed, outdated primatology confused high rank with leadership in silly ways. An alpha male baboon is not a leader. He just gets the best stuff. And while everyone follows a knowledgeable old female when she chooses her foraging route in the morning, there is every indication that she is going rather than leading. But humans have leaders, anchored in the unique notion of the common good. What counts as the common good and the leader's role in fostering it obviously varies, ranging from leading the horde in the siege of a castle to leading a bird-watching walk. Even more newfangled is humans choosing their leaders, whether selecting a clan head by acclamation around the campfire or a 3-year-long presidential campaign season topped with the bizarreness of the Electoral College. How do we choose leaders? A frequent conscious component of decision-making is to vote for experience or competence rather than for stances on specific issues. This is so common that in one study, faces judged to look more competent won elections 68% of the time. People also make conscious voting choices based on single, potentially irrelevant issues, e.g., voting for assistant county dog catcher based on the candidate's stances on drone warfare in Pakistan. And then there's the facet of American decision-making that baffles citizens of other democracies, namely voting for likability. Just consider Bush versus Kerry in 2004, where Republican pundits suggested that people's choice for the most powerful position on Earth should reflect which guy you'd rather have a beer with. At least as interesting are the automatic and unconscious elements of decision-making. As probably the strongest factor of candidates with identical political stances, people are more likely to vote for the better-looking one. Given the preponderance of male candidates and office holders, this mostly translates into voting for masculine traits. Tall, healthy-looking, symmetrical features, high forehead, prominent brow ridges, jutting jaw. As first raised in Chapter 3, this fits into the larger phenomenon of attractive people typically being rated as having better personalities and higher moral standards, and as being kinder, more honest, more friendly, and more trustworthy. And they are treated better. For the same resume, being more likely to be hired. For the same job, getting a higher salary. For the same crime, being less likely to be convicted. This is the beauty is good stereotype, summarized in an 1882 quote by Friedrich Schiller. Physical beauty is the sign of an interior beauty, a spiritual and moral beauty. This is the flip side of the view that disfigurement, illness, and injury are karmic payback for one's sins. And as we saw in Chapter 3, we use the same circuitry in the orbitofrontal PFC when we evaluate the moral goodness of an act and the beauty of a face. Other implicit factors come into play. One study examined the campaign speeches of candidates in every prime minister election in Australian history. In 80% of elections, the winner was the one to use more collective pronouns, i.e. we and us, suggesting an attraction to candidates who speak on everyone's behalf. There are also contingent automatic preferences. For example, in scenarios concerning war, both Western and East Asian subjects prefer candidates with older, more masculine faces. During peacetime, it's younger, more feminine faces. Furthermore, in scenarios involving fostering cooperation between groups, intelligent-looking faces are preferred. At other times, more intelligent faces are viewed as less masculine or desirable. These automatic biases fall into place early in life. One study showed kids, ages 5 to 13, pairs of faces of candidates from obscure elections and ask them whom they prefer as captain on a hypothetical boat trip. And kids pick the winner 71% of the time. Scientists doing these studies often speculate as to why such preferences have evolved. Frankly, much of this feels like just-so stories. For example, in analyzing the preference for leaders with more masculine faces during war, the authors noted that high testosterone levels produce both more masculine facial features, generally true, and more aggressive behavior, not true, back to chapter 4, and that aggressiveness is what you want in a leader during times of war. Personally, not so sure about that one. Thus, preferring candidates with more masculine faces increases the odds of landing the aggressive leader you need to triumph in war. And everyone then passes on more copies of their genes, voila. Regardless of causes, the main point is the power of these forces. 5-year-olds with 71% accuracy demonstrate that these are some very generalized, deeply entrenched biases. And then our conscious cognitions play catch-up to make our decision seem careful and wise. Oh, why not take this one on? Politics and political orientations. So humans keep getting weirder. Multiple hierarchies and having leaders and occasionally choosing them and doing so with some silly implicit criteria. Now let's plunge into politics. Franz de Waal introduced the term politics into primatology with his classic book Chimpanzee Politics, using it in the sense of Machiavellian intelligence. Non-human primates struggling in socially complex manners to control access to resources. The book documents chimpanzee genius for such maneuvering. This is politics in the traditional human sense as well. But I will use a more restricted, starry-eyed sense, which is politics being the struggle among the powerful with differing visions of the common good. Forget liberals accusing conservatives of waging war on the poor. Ditto conservatives accusing those depraved liberals of destroying family values. Cutting through this posturing, we'll assume that everyone equally desires that people do as well as possible, but differs as to how best to accomplish this. In this section, we'll focus on 3 issues. A. Do political orientations tend to be internally consistent? E.g., do people's opinions about their town's littering policy and about military actions in somewhere-istan come as an ideological package? Quick answer, usually. B. Do such consistent orientations arise from deep implicit factors with remarkably little to do with specific political issues? Yep. C. Can one begin to detect the bits of biology underlying these factors? Of course. The internal consistency of political orientation. The previous chapter examined the remarkable consistency in us-them orientations. People who dislike a particular outgroup on economic grounds are likelier than chance to dislike another group on historical grounds, another on cultural, and so on. Much the same is true here. Social, economic, environmental, and international political orientations tend to come in a package. This consistency explains the humor behind a New Yorker cartoon, pointed out by the political psychologist John Jost, showing a woman modeling a dress for her husband and asking, "Does this dress make me look Republican?" Another example concerns the bioethicist Leon Kass, who not only has had influential conservative stances on human cloning, finding the possibility repugnant, but also finds it repugnant when people display the cat-like activity of licking ice cream cones in public. More to come on his issues, including with licking ice cream cones. What this internal consistency suggests is that political ideology is merely one manifestation of broader, underlying ideology. As we'll see, this helps explain conservatives being more likely than liberals to have cleaning supplies in their bedrooms. Naturally, strict consistency in political ideology isn't always the rule. Libertarians are a mixture of social liberalism and economic conservatism. Conversely, Black Baptist churches are traditionally economically liberal but socially conservative. For example, rejecting both gay rights and the idea that gay rights are a form of civil rights. Moreover, neither extreme of political ideology is monolithic. And ignoring that, I'll be simplifying throughout by using liberal and left-wing interchangeably, as well as conservative and right-wing. Nonetheless, the building blocks of political orientation tend to be stable and internally consistent. It's usually possible to dress like a Republican or lick ice cream like a Democrat. Implicit factors underlying political orientation. If political ideology is but one manifestation of larger internal forces pertinent to everything from cleaning supplies in the bedroom to ice cream consumption, are there psychological, affective, cognitive, and visceral ways in which leftists and rightists tend to differ? This question has produced deeply fascinating findings. I'll try to corral them into some categories. Intelligence. Oh, what the hell? Let's begin with something inflammatory. Starting with Theodore Adorno in the 1950s, people have suggested that lower intelligence predicts adherence to conservative ideology. Some, but not all studies since then, have supported this conclusion. More consistent has been a link between lower intelligence and a subtype of conservatism, namely right-wing authoritarianism, RWA, a fondness for hierarchy. One particularly thorough demonstration of this involved more than 15,000 subjects in the UK and United States. Importantly, the links among low IQ, RWA, and intergroup prejudice were there after controlling for education and socioeconomic status. The standard, convincing explanation for the link is that RWA provides simple answers, ideal for people with poor abstract reasoning skills. Intellectual style. This literature has two broad themes. One is that rightists are relatively uncomfortable intellectually with ambiguity. This is covered below. The other is that leftists, well, think harder, have a greater capacity for what the political scientist Philip Tetlock of the University of Pennsylvania calls integrative complexity. In one study, conservatives and liberals, when asked about the causes of poverty, both tended toward personal attributions. They're poor because they're lazy. But only if they had to make snap judgments. Give people more time, and liberals shifted toward situational explanations. Wait, things are stacked against the poor. In other words, conservatives start gut and stay gut. Liberals go from gut to head. This differing attributional style extends way beyond politics. Tell liberals or conservatives about a guy who trips over someone's feet while learning a dance, ask for a snap assessment, and everyone does personal attribution. The guy's clumsy. It's only with time that the liberals go situational. Maybe the dance is really difficult. Obviously, this dichotomy isn't perfect. Rightists did personal attribution for Lewinsky Gate, Bill Clinton's rotten, while leftists did situational. It's a vast right-wing conspiracy. And things ran the opposite with Nixon and Watergate. However, they are pretty reliable. Why the difference? Liberals and conservatives are equally capable of thinking past gut personal attributions to subtler situational ones. When asked to do so, both are equally adept at dispassionately presenting the viewpoints of the opposite camp. It's that liberals are more motivated to push towards situational explanations. Why? Some have suggested it's a greater respect for thinking, which readily becomes an unhelpful tautology. Linda Skitka of the University of Illinois emphasizes how the personal attributions of snap judgments readily feel dissonant to liberals, at odds with their principles. Thus, they are motivated to think their way to a more consonant view. In contrast, even with more time, conservatives don't become more situational, because there's no dissonance. While logical, this just turfs us to asking where the liberal ideology causing the dissonance comes from in the first place. As we'll see, it comes from factors having little to do with cognitive style. These findings suggest that it's easier to make a liberal think like a conservative than the other way around. Or, stated in a familiar way, increasing cognitive load should make people more conservative. This is precisely the case. The time pressure of snap judgments is a version of increased cognitive load. Likewise, people become more conservative when tired, in pain, or distracted with a cognitive task, or when blood alcohol levels rise. Recall from Chapter 3 that willpower takes metabolic power, thanks to the glucose demands of the frontal cortex. This was the finding that when people are hungry, they become less generous in economic games. A real-world example of this is startling. In a study of more than 1,100 judicial rulings, prisoners were granted parole at about a 60% rate when judges had recently eaten, and at essentially a 0% rate just before judges ate. Note also the overall decline over the course of a tiring day. Justice may be blind, but she's sure sensitive to her stomach gurgling. Moral cognition. Another minefield. Surprise, people at both ends of the political spectrum accuse the other side of impoverished moral thought. One direction of this is seemingly bolstered by Chapter 7's Kohlberg Stages of Moral Development. Liberals, steeped in civil disobedience, tend to be at a higher Kohlberg stage than our conservatives, with their fondness for law and order. Are rightists less intellectually capable of reasoning at a more advanced Kohlberg stage, or are they less motivated to do so? Seemingly the latter. Rightists and leftists are equally capable of presenting the other's perspective. Jonathan Haidt of NYU provides a very different view. He identifies six foundations of morality: care versus harm, fairness versus cheating, liberty versus oppression, loyalty versus betrayal, authority versus subversion, sanctity versus degradation. Both experimental and real-world data show that liberals preferentially value the first three goals, namely care, fairness, and liberty, and, showing an overlap with Kohlbergian formulations, undervaluing loyalty, authority, and sanctity is in many ways synonymous with post-conventional thinking. In contrast, conservatives heavily value loyalty, authority, and sanctity. Obviously, this is a big difference. Is it okay to criticize your group to outsiders? Rightists? No, that's disloyal. Leftists? Yes, if justified. Should you ever disobey a law? Rightists? No, that undermines authority. Leftists? Of course, if it's a bad law. Is it okay to burn the flag? Rightists? Never, it's sacred. Leftists? Come on, it's a piece of cloth. These differing emphases explain a lot. For example, the classical liberal view is that everyone has equal rights to happiness. Rightists instead discount fairness in favor of expedient authority, generating the classical conservative view that some socioeconomic inequality is a tolerable price for things running smoothly. What does it mean that, in Haidt's view, conservatives count up six moral foundations on their toes and liberals only three? Here is where internecine sniping starts. Conservatives embrace Haidt's characterization of liberals as being morally impoverished, with half their moral foundations atrophied. The opposite interpretation, espoused by Jost and Joshua Green of Harvard, is that liberals have more refined moral foundations, having jettisoned the less important, more historically damaging ones that conservatives perseverate on. In effect, liberals count from 1 to 3, while conservatives really only count 4 to 6. Why are conservatives more concerned with binding foundations like loyalty, authority, and sanctity, often stepping stones to right-wing authoritarianism and social dominance orientation? This segues to the next section. Affective psychological differences. Research consistently shows that leftists and rightists differ in overlapping categories of emotional makeup. To summarize, on the average, rightists are made more anxious by ambiguity and have a stronger need for closure, dislike novelty, are more comforted by structure and hierarchy, more readily perceive circumstances as threatening, and are more parochial in their empathy. The conservative dislike of ambiguity has been demonstrated in numerous apolitical contexts, e.g. responses to visual illusions, taste and entertainment, and is closely related to the differing feelings about novelty, which by definition evokes ambiguity and uncertainty. The differing views of novelty certainly explain the liberal view that with correct reforms, our best days are ahead of us in a novel future, whereas conservatives view our best days as behind us, in familiar circumstances that should be returned to make things great again. Once again, these differences in psychological makeup play out in apolitical realms as well. Liberals are more likely to own travel books than are conservatives. The conservative need for predictability and structure obviously fuels the emphasis on loyalty, obedience, and law and order. It also gives insights into a puzzling feature of the political landscape. How is it that over the last 50 years, Republicans have persuaded impoverished white Americans to so often vote against their own economic self-interest? Do they actually believe that they're going to win the lottery and then get to enjoy the privileged side of American inequality? Nah. The psychological issues of needing structured familiarity show that for poor whites, voting Republican constitutes an implicit act of system justification and risk aversion. Better to resist change and deal with the devil that you know. Harking back to the last chapter, gay conservatives show more implicit anti-gay biases than do gay liberals. Better to hate who you are if that bolsters a system whose stability and predictability are sources of comfort. Intertwined with these variables is the left-right difference in tendency to see things as threatening, particularly when conservatism is anchored in authoritarianism. Life is filled with ambiguity, most of all with the novel future. And if those make you anxious, lots of things will seem threatening. Now, a threat can be abstract, such as to your self-esteem. There are few political differences in the perception of such threats. The differences concern concrete threats to your keister. This helps explain political stances. "I have a list here of 200 communist spies working in the State Department" is a pretty good demonstration of imagined threat. The difference in threat perception can be apolitical. In one study, subjects had to rapidly do a task when a word flashed up on a screen. Authoritarian conservatives, but not liberals, responded more rapidly to threatening words like cancer, snake, or mugger, than to non-threatening words, e.g. telescope, tree, canteen. Moreover, as compared with liberals, such conservatives are more likely to associate arms with weapons, rather than with legs, more likely to interpret ambiguous faces as threatening, and more easily conditioned to associate negative, but not positive, stimuli with neutral stimuli. Republicans report three times as many nightmares as do Democrats, particularly ones involving loss of personal power. As the saying goes, a conservative is a liberal who has been mugged. Related to this is terror management theory, which suggests that conservatism is psychologically rooted in a pronounced fear of death. Supporting this is the finding that priming people to think about their mortality makes them more conservative. These differences in threat perception help explain the differing views as to role of government, providing for people, the leftist view, social services, education, etc., or protecting people, the rightist view, law and order, the military, etc. Fear, anxiety, the terror of mortality, it must be a drag being right-wing. But despite that, in a multinational study, rightists were happier than leftists. Why? Perhaps it's having simpler answers, unburdened by motivated correction. Or, as favored by the authors, because system justification allows conservatives to rationalize and be less discomfited by inequality. And as economic inequality rises, the happiness gap between the right and the left increases. As emphasized, political ideology is just one manifestation of intellectual and emotional style. As a great example, a 4-year-old's openness to a new toy predicts how open she'll be as an adult to, say, the United States forging new relations with Iran or Cuba. And of course, some underlying biology. We've now seen that political orientation is usually stable and internally consistent across a range of disparate issues, and that it is typically merely one manifestation of a package of cognitive and affective style. Stepping deeper, what are the biological correlates of differing political orientations? Back to the insular cortex and its role in mediating gustatory and olfactory disgust in mammals and in mediating moral disgust in humans. Recall from the last chapter how you can reliably stoke hatred of thems by making them seem viscerally disgusting. When people's insuli activate at the thought of thems, you can check one thing off your genocide to-do list. This recalls a remarkable finding. Stick subjects in a room with a smelly garbage can, and they become more socially conservative. If your insula is gagging from the smell of dead fish, you're more likely to decide that a social practice of an other that is merely different is, instead, just plain wrong. This leads to a thoroughly fascinating finding. Social conservatives tend toward lower thresholds for disgust than liberals. In one study, subjects were exposed to either positively or negatively charged emotional images, and galvanic skin resistance, GSR, an indirect measure of sympathetic nervous system arousal, was measured. The biggest autonomic responses to negative, but not positive, emotional images were in conservatives opposed to gay marriage or premarital sex, while GSR response was unrelated to non-social issues like free trade or gun control. Concerns about hygiene and purity sure predict valuing of sanctity. Related to that, when confronted with something viscerally disturbing, conservatives are less likely to use reappraisal strategies, e.g., when seeing something gory, thinking, this isn't real, it's staged. Moreover, when conservatives, but not liberals, are instructed to use reappraisal techniques, e.g., try to view the images in a detached, unemotional way, they express less conservative political sentiments. In contrast, a suppression strategy, don't let your feelings show when you're looking at this image, doesn't work. As we saw, make a liberal tired, hungry, rushed, distracted, or disgusted, and they become more conservative. Make a conservative more detached about something viscerally disturbing, and they become more liberal. Thus, political orientation about social issues reflects sensitivity to visceral disgust and strategies for coping with such disgust. In addition, conservatives are more likely to think that disgust is a good metric for deciding whether something is moral, which recalls Leon Cass, the bioethicist with the ice cream licking issues. He headed George W. Bush's bioethics panel, one that, thanks to Cass's anti-abortion ideology, greatly restricted embryonic stem cell research. Cass has argued for what he calls the wisdom of repugnance, where disgust at something like human cloning can be the emotional expression of deep wisdom beyond wisdom's power completely to articulate it. The visceral level, with or without post-hoc rationalization, is all you need in order to know what's right. If it makes you puke, then you must rebuke. The monumental flaw is obvious. Different things disgust different people. Whose gag reflex wins? Moreover, things once viewed as disgusting are viewed differently now. E.g., the idea of slaves having the same rights as whites would probably have struck most white Americans circa 1800 as not just economically unworkable, but disgusting as well. It's disgusting, the things people weren't disgusted by in the past. Disgust is a moving target. Thus, issues anchored in the insula help explain differences in political orientation. This point will be returned to in Chapter 17. Additional neurobiological differences have been demonstrated. Liberalism has been associated with larger amounts of gray matter in the cingulate cortex, with its involvement in empathy, whereas conservatism has been associated with an enlarged amygdala, with, of course, its starring role in threat perception. Moreover, there's more amygdala activation in conservatives than in liberals when viewing a disgusting image or doing a risky task. But not all the findings fit easily. For example, when looking at disgusting images, conservatives also show relatively greater activation of a hodgepodge of other brain regions, the basal ganglia, thalamus, periaqueductal gray, cognitive, DLPFC, middle/superior temporal gyrus, presupplementary motor, fusiform, and inferior frontal gyrus. How all those fit together isn't clear. Naturally, one must ask, have behavior geneticists reported genetic influences on political orientation? Twin studies report heritability of about 50% for political orientation. Genome-wide survey approaches have identified genes whose polymorphic variants were associated with political orientation. Most of the genes had no known functions or were previously thought to be unrelated to the brain. Those whose brain-related functions were known, for example, one coded for a receptor for the neurotransmitter glutamate, don't teach much about political orientation. As an interesting gene-environment interaction, the risk-taking version of the D4 dopamine receptor gene is associated with liberals, but only in people with lots of friends. Moreover, some studies show a genetic association with people's likelihood of voting, independent of political orientation. Interesting. However, the approach comes with all of Chapter 8's caveats. Most findings haven't been replicated, reported effects are small, and these are published in political science journals rather than genetics journals. Finally, to the extent that genes are related to political orientation, links are likely to be via intervening factors, such as the tendency toward anxiety. Obedience and conformity, disobedience and nonconformity. So humans have multiple simultaneous hierarchies and hierarchies built around abstractions, and occasionally choose leaders who labor for the common good. Add to that, obedience to leaders. This is utterly different from a schlub of a baboon obediently surrendering his spot in the shade to the looming alpha male. Instead, humans show obedience to authority that transcends any given occupant of a throne. The king is dead, long live the king, to the very notion of authority. Its elements range from loyalty, admiration, and emulation to brown-nosing, sycophancy, and instrumental self-interest, and can range from mere compliance, i.e., the public conformity of going along without actually agreeing, to drinking the Kool-Aid, i.e., identifying with the authority and internalizing and extending its beliefs. Obedience is closely intertwined with conformity, a concept central to the previous chapter but considered here. Both consist of going along, the former with a group, the latter with authority. And for us, the commonalities are what matter. Moreover, the opposites, disobedience and nonconformity, are also intertwined and range from the independence of marching to a different drummer to the intentionality and mirrored determinism of anti-conformity. Importantly, these are value-free terms. Conformity can be great. It's helpful if everyone in a culture agrees on whether shaking your head up and down means yes or no. Conforming is necessary for the benefits of the wisdom of the crowd, and it can be truly comforting. But obviously, conformity can be horrendous. Joining in on bullying, oppressing, shunning, expelling, killing, just because everyone else is on board. Obedience can be swell, too, ranging from everyone stopping at stop signs to the embarrassment of my pseudo-anarchist adolescence, my kids listening when my wife and I say it's bedtime. And malign obedience obviously underlies just following orders, from goose-stepping to Jonestown's wretched obeying the command to kill their children. Roots. Conformity and obedience have deep roots, as evidenced by their presence in other species and in very young humans. Animal conformity is a type of social learning. A subordinate primate does not have to be thrashed by some bruiser in order to express subordination to him. Everyone else's doing so can be sufficient. The conformity has a familiar human tinge to it. For example, a chimp is more likely to copy an action if he sees three other individuals do it once each than if one other individual does it three times. Moreover, learning can include cultural transmission. In chimps, for example, this includes learning types of tool construction. Conformity relates to social and emotional contagion, where, say, a primate aggressively targets an individual just because someone else is already doing so. Such contagion even works between groups. For example, among marmosets, aggression in a group becomes more likely if aggressive vocalizations are heard from the neighboring group. Other primates are even subject to the social contagion of yawning. Footnote. Chimp yawning is most readily evoked by watching yawning by another familiar chimp, next most readily by watching a familiar human yawning, followed by an unfamiliar human yawning. However, contagious yawning is not evoked by an unfamiliar chimp or an unfamiliar primate species, a baboon. My favorite example of non-human conformity is so familiar that it could come right out of high school. A male grouse courts a female who, alas, doesn't feel magic in the air and rebuffs him. The researchers then make him seem like the hottest stud on the prairie by surrounding him with some rapt, stuffed female grouse. Soon the reluctant maiden is all over him, pushing her statuesque rivals aside. An even clearer demonstration of animal conformity was shown in a beautiful study of chimpanzees by Franz de Waal. In each of two groups, the alpha female was separated from the rest and shown how to open a puzzle box containing food. Crucially, the two were shown different, equally difficult ways of doing it. Once the females had mastered their approaches, the chimps in each group got to watch their alpha female strut her stuff repeatedly with the puzzle box. Finally, everyone got access to the puzzle box and promptly copied their alpha's technique. Thus, this is a cool demonstration of the spread of cultural information. But something even more interesting happened. A chimp in the group would occasionally stumble onto the alternative method, and would then abandon it, going back to doing it the normal way. Just because everyone else was doing so. The same phenomenon was subsequently shown in capuchin monkeys and wild birds. Thus, animals will perform one version of a behavior not because it is better, but simply because everyone else does. Even more striking, animal conformity can be detrimental. In a 2013 study, Andrew Whiten of the University of St. Andrews presented wild vervet monkeys with two bins of maize, dyed either pink or blue. One color tasted fine, the other had a bitter additive. The monkeys learned to avoid the latter, and months later still ate only the safe colored maize, even after the additive was omitted. As infants were born, or adults who had grown up elsewhere migrated into the group, they conformed to this food choice, learning to eat only the same color food as everyone else. In other words, foregoing half the potential food just because of the need to fit in. Monkeys joining the herd, acting like sheep, going over the cliff like lemmings. One example starkly displays the same in humans. In life-threatening emergencies, e.g. a restaurant fire, people frequently attempt to escape by following the crowd in what they know to be the wrong direction. The deeply ingrained nature of human conformity and obedience in humans is shown by the ages when they are apparent. As detailed in Chapter 7, zillions of pages have been written about conformity and peer pressure in kids. One study nicely demonstrates the continuity of conformity between us and other species. This was the report that a chimp was more likely to conform to the behaviors of three individuals doing a behavior once each than to one individual doing the behavior three times. The study showed the same in two-year-old humans. The depths of human conformity and obedience are shown by the speed with which they occur. It takes less than 200 milliseconds for your brain to register that the group has picked a different answer from yours, and less than 380 milliseconds for a profile of activation that predicts changing your opinion. Our brains are biased to get along by going along in less than a second. Neural bases. This last study raises the question of what occurs in the brain under these circumstances. Our usual cast of brain regions pops up in informative ways. The influential social identity theory posits that our concept of who we are is heavily shaped by social context, by the groups we do or don't identify with. In that view, conformity and obedience, while certainly about avoiding punishment, are at least as much about the positives of fitting in. When we imitate someone's actions, our mesolimbic dopamine system activates. When we choose incorrectly in a task, the dopaminergic decline is less if we made the decision as part of a group than if we did so as an individual. Belonging is safety. In numerous studies, a subject in a group answers some question, finds out after that, oh no, everyone else disagrees, and can then change their answer. No surprise, the discovery that you are out of step activates the amygdala and insular cortex. The more activation, the greater your likelihood of changing your mind, and the more persistent the change, as opposed to the transient change of compliant public conformity. This is a profoundly social phenomenon. People are more likely to change their answer if you show them a picture of the person or persons who disagree with them. When you get the news that everyone else disagrees with you, there is also activation of the emotional, the MPFC, the anterior cingulate cortex, and the nucleus accumbens. This is a network mobilized during reinforcement learning, where you learn to modify your behavior when there is a mismatch between what you expected to happen and what actually did. Find out that everyone disagrees with you, and this network activates. What is it basically telling you? Not just that you're different from everyone else, that you're wrong. Being different equals being wrong. The greater the activation of this circuit, the greater the likelihood of changing answers to conform. Like most of the neuroimaging literature, these studies are merely correlative. Thus, particularly important is a 2011 study that used transcranial magnetic stimulation techniques to temporarily inactivate the VMPFC. Subjects became less likely to change their answer to conform. Back to the contrast between conforming taking the form of, you know what, if everyone says they saw B, I guess I did too, whatever. And it's taking the form of, now that I think about it, I didn't actually see A, I think I saw B. In fact, I'm certain of it. The latter is associated with activation of the hippocampus, the brain region central to learning and memory. The revisionism involves you literally revising your memory. Remarkably, in another study, this process of conforming was also associated with activation of the occipital cortex, the brain region that does the primary processing of vision. You can almost hear the frontal and limbic parts of the brain trying to convince the occipital cortex that it saw something different from what it actually saw. As has been said, winners, in this case in the court of public opinion, get to write the history books, and everyone else better revise theirs accordingly. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. That dot you saw was actually blue, not red. Thus, the neurobiology of conforming consists of a first wave of anxiety where we equate differentness with wrongness, followed by the cognitive work needed to change our opinion. These findings obviously come from an artificial world of psych experiments. Thus, they're only a faint whisper of what occurs when it's you against the rest of the jury, when it's you being urged to join the lynch mob, when it's you choosing between conforming and being deeply lonely. What is the neurobiology of obedience to authority when you're being ordered to do something wrong? A similar mixture as with conformity, with the VMPFC and the DLPFC mud wrestling, with indices of anxiety and glucocorticoid stress hormones showing up to bias you towards subordination. Which leads us to consider classic studies of just following orders. Ash, Milgram, and Zimbardo. The neurobiology of conformity and obedience won't soon be revealing much about the core question in this field. If the circumstances are right, is every human capable of doing something appalling simply because they've been ordered to, because everyone else is doing it? It is virtually required by law to discuss three of the most influential, daring, disturbing, and controversial studies in the history of psychology, namely the conformity experiments of Solomon Ash, the shock-slash-obedience studies of Stanley Milgram, and the Stanford prison experiment of Philip Zimbardo. The grandparent of the trio was Ash, working in the early 1950s at Swarthmore College. The format of his studies was simple. A volunteer, thinking that this was a study of perception, would be given a pair of cards. One card would have a line on it, the other a trio of different length lines, one of which matched the length of the singleton line. Which line of the trio is the same length as the singleton? Easy. Volunteers sitting alone in a room had about a 1% error rate over a series of cases. Meanwhile, the volunteers in the experimental group take the test in a room with seven others, each saying his choice out loud. Unbeknownst to the volunteer, the other seven worked on the project. The volunteer would just happen to go last, and the first seven would unanimously pick a glaringly wrong answer. Stunningly, volunteers would now agree with that incorrect answer about a third of the time, something replicated frequently in the cottage industry of research spawned by Ash. Whether due to the person's actually changing their mind or they're merely deciding to go along, this was a startling demonstration of conformity. On to the Milgram obedience experiment, whose first incarnations appeared in the early 1960s at Yale. a pair of volunteers would show up for a psychology study of memory. One would arbitrarily be designated the teacher, the other the learner. Learner and teacher would be in separate rooms, hearing but not seeing each other. In the room with the teacher would be the lab-coated scientist supervising the study. The teacher would recite pairs of words from a list given by the scientist. The learner was supposed to remember their pairing. After a series of these, the teacher would test the learner's memory of the pairings. Each time the learner made a mistake, the teacher was supposed to shock them. With each mistake, shock intensity increased up to a life-threatening 450 volts, ending the session. Teachers thought the shocks were real. At the start, they'd been given a real shock, supposedly of the intensity of the first punitive one. It hurt. In reality, no punitive shocks were given. The learner worked on the project. As the intensity of the supposed shocks increased, the teacher would hear the learner responding in pain, crying out, begging for the teacher to stop. Footnote. As a slick part of the design, it wasn't the actor in the next room doing this emoting. Instead, pressing the shock button of each particular intensity triggered the playing of a particular recording of sounds commensurate with that shock intensity. This would standardize the supposed agony of the learner from one subject to the next. In one variant, the volunteer, who became the learner, mentioned in passing that he had a heart condition. As shock intensity increased, this learner would scream about chest pains and then go silent, seemingly having passed out. Amid the screams of pain, teachers would typically become hesitant, at which point they'd be urged on by the scientist with commands of increasing intensity. Please continue. The experiment requires that you continue. It is absolutely essential that you continue. You have no other choice. You must go on. And the scientist assured them they weren't responsible. The learner had been informed of the risks. And the famed result was that most volunteers complied, shocking the learner repeatedly. Teachers would typically try to stop, argue with the scientist, would even weep in distress, but would obey. In the original study, horrifically, 65% of them administered the maximum shock of 450 volts. And then there's the Stanford Prison Experiment, SPE, carried out by Zimbardo in 1971. 24 young male volunteers, mostly college students, were randomly split into a group of 12 prisoners and 12 guards. The prisoners were to spend 7 to 14 days jailed in a pseudo-prison in the basement of Stanford's psychology department. The guards were to keep order. Tremendous effort went into making the SPE realistic. The future prisoners thought they were scheduled to show up at the building at a particular time to start the study. Instead, Palo Alto police helped Zimbardo by showing up earlier at each prisoner's home, arresting him, and taking him to the police station for booking, fingerprinting, mugshots, the works. Prisoners were then deposited in the prison, strip-searched, given prison garb, along with stocking hats to simulate their heads being shaved, and dumped as trios in cells. The guards, in surplus military khakis, batons, and reflective sunglasses, ruled. They had been informed that while there was no violence allowed, they could make the prisoners feel bored, afraid, helpless, humiliated, and without a sense of privacy or individuality. And the result was just as famously horrific as that of the Milgram experiment. The guards put prisoners through pointless, humiliating rituals of obedience, forced painful exercise, deprived them of sleep and food, forced them to relieve themselves in unemptied buckets in the cells, rather than escorting them to the bathroom, put people in solitary, set prisoners against each other, addressed them by number rather than by name. The prisoners, meanwhile, had a range of responses. One cell revolted on the second day, refusing to obey the guards and barricading the entrance to their cell. Guards subdued them with fire extinguishers. Other prisoners resisted more individualistically. Most eventually sank into passivity and despair. The experiment ended famously. 6 days into it, as the brutality and degradation worsened, Zimbardo was persuaded to halt the study by a graduate student, Christina Moslak. They later married. situational forces, and what lurks in all of us. These studies are famed, have inspired movies and novels, have entered the common culture, with predictably horrendous misrepresentations. They brought renown and notoriety to Ash, Milgram, and Zimbardo, and they were vastly influential in scientific circles. According to Google Scholar, Ash's work is cited more than 4,000 times in the literature, Milgram's more than 27,000 times, the SPE more than 58,000. Footnote. One study inspired by Milgram was the Hoffling Hospital experiment, in which nurses, unaware that they were in an experiment, would be ordered by an unknown doctor to give a dangerously high dose of a medication to a patient. Despite their knowing of the danger, 21 out of 22 nurses were willing to comply. The number of times your average science paper is cited can be counted on one hand, with most of the citations by the scientist's mother. The trio is a cornerstone of social psychology. In the words of Harvard psychologist Mazarin Banaji, the primary simple lesson the SPE, and by extension Ash and Milgram, teaches is that situations matter, her emphasis. What did they show? Thanks to Ash, that average people will go along with absurdly incorrect assertions in the name of conformity. And thanks to the other two studies, that average people will do stunningly bad things in the name of obedience and conformity. The larger implications of this are enormous. Ash and Milgram, the former a Jewish Eastern European immigrant, the latter the son of Jewish Eastern European immigrants, worked in the era of the intellectual challenge of making sense of Germans just following orders. Milgram's study was prompted by the start, a few months earlier, of the war crimes trial of Adolf Eichmann, the man who famously epitomized the banality of evil because of his seeming normalcy. Zimbardo's work burst forth during the Vietnam War era with the likes of the My Lai massacre, and the SPE became bitingly relevant 30 years later with the abuse and torture of Iraqis at Abu Ghraib prison by perfectly normal American soldiers. Zimbardo took a particularly extreme stance as to what these findings mean, namely his bad barrel theory. The issue isn't how a few bad apples can ruin the whole barrel. It's how a bad barrel can turn any apple bad. In another apt metaphor, rather than concentrating on one evil person at a time, what Zimbardo calls a medical approach, one must understand how some environments cause epidemics of evil, a public health approach. As he states, any deed, for good or evil, that any human being has ever done, you and I could also do, given the same situational forces. Anyone could potentially be an abusive Milgram teacher, Zimbardo guard, or goose-stepping Nazi. In a similar vein, Milgram stated, if a system of death camps were set up in the U.S. of the sorts we had seen in Nazi Germany, one would be able to find sufficient personnel for those camps in any medium-sized American town. And as stated by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago, in a quote perpetually cited in this literature, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? Some different takes. Big surprise, the studies and their conclusions, especially those of Milgram and Zimbardo, have been controversial. Those two attracted firestorms of controversy because of the unethical nature of the work. Some teachers and guards were psychological wrecks afterward, seeing what they had proven capable of. Footnote. Remember, these were predominantly psychologically sound college students. In the SPE, nearly all of them had indicated at the beginning that they would rather be a prisoner than a guard, and a number indicated that they had volunteered in order to learn what prison would be like, expecting to be jailed at some point for civil rights or anti-war activity. And as is often underemphasized in accounts of the SPE, many of the prisoners, as well as the guards, were deeply distressed afterward, having seen how readily they were broken into passivity. It changed the course of a number of their lives. Footnote. One teacher, for example, became a conscientious objector during Vietnam, prompted by his horror at his behavior in the study. No Human Subjects Committee would approve the Milgram study these days. In contemporary versions, subjects are ordered to, for example, say increasingly insulting things to the learner, or administer virtual shocks, evoking virtual pain in avatars. Stay tuned. The controversies about the science itself in the Milgram and Zimbardo studies are more pertinent. The Milgram edifice has been questioned in three ways, most piercingly by the psychologist Gina Perry. Milgram seems to have fudged some of his work. Perry has analyzed Milgram's unpublished papers and recordings of sessions, finding that teachers refused to shock much more frequently than reported. However, despite the seemingly inflated results, the finding of roughly 60% compliance rates has been replicated. Few of the replicating studies were traditional academic ones published in peer-reviewed journals. Instead, most have been recreations for films and television programs. Perhaps most important, as analyzed by Perry, far more teachers than Milgram indicated realized that the learner was an actor and that there were no actual shocks. This problem probably extends to the replications as well. The SPE has arguably attracted the most controversy. The biggest lightning rod was the role of Zimbardo himself. Rather than being a detached observer, he served as the prison's superintendent. He set the ground rules, e.g., telling guards that they could make the prisoners feel afraid and helpless, and met regularly with the guards throughout. He was clearly excited as hell to see what was happening in the study. Zimbardo is a larger-than-life force of nature, someone whom you'd very much wish to please. Thus, guards were subject to pressure not only to conform with their cohort, but also to obey and please Zimbardo. His role, consciously or otherwise, almost certainly prompted the guards to more extreme behavior. Zimbardo, a humane, decent man who is a friend and colleague, has written at length about this distortive impact that he had on the study. At the beginning of the study, volunteers were randomly assigned to be guards or prisoners, and the resulting two groups did not differ on various personality measures. While that's great, what was not appreciated was the possibility that the volunteers as a whole were distinctive. This was tested in a 2007 study in which volunteers were recruited through one of two newspaper ads. The first described a psychological study of prison life, the words used in the advertisement for the SPE, while in the other, the word prison was omitted. The two groups of volunteers then underwent personality testing. Importantly, volunteers for the prison study scored higher than the others on measures of aggressiveness, authoritarianism, and social dominance, and lower for empathy and altruism. Insofar as both guards and prisoners in the SPE might have had this makeup, it's not clear why that would have biased toward the famously brutal outcome. Finally, there's science's gold standard, independent replication. If you redid the SPE, down to matching the brand of the guard's socks, would you get the same result? Any study this big, idiosyncratic, and expensive would be difficult to match perfectly in the replication attempt. Moreover, Zimbardo actually published remarkably little of the data about the SPE in professional journals. Instead, he mostly wrote for the lay public, hard to resist given the attention the study garnered. Thus, there's only really been one attempted replication. The 2001 BBC prison study was run by two respected British psychologists, Stephen Riker of the University of St. Andrews and Alex Haslam of the University of Exeter. As the name implies, it was carried out, i.e. among other things, paid for, by the BBC, which filmed it for a documentary. Its design replicated the broad features of the SPE. As is so often the case, there was a completely different outcome. To summarize a book's worth of complex events. Prisoners organized to resist any abuse by the guards. Prisoner morale soared, while guards became demoralized and divided. This led to a collapse of the guard-prisoner power differential and ushered in a cooperative, power-sharing commune, which lasted only briefly before three ex-prisoners and one ex-guard overthrew the Utopians and instituted a draconian regime. Fascinatingly, those four had scored highest on scales of authoritarianism before the study began. As the new regime settled into repressive power, the study was terminated. Thus, rather than a replication of the SPE, this wound up being more like a replication of the FRE and the RRE, i.e. the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. A hierarchical regime is overthrown by wet-nosed idealists who know all the songs from Les Mis, who are then devoured by Bolsheviks or Reign of Terrorists. Importantly, the ruling junta at the end, having entered the study with the strongest predispositions toward authoritarianism, certainly suggests bad apples rather than bad barrels. Even bigger surprise, stop the presses, Zimbardo criticized the study, arguing that its structure invalidated it as a chance to replicate the SPE, that guard-prisoner assignments could not have really been random, and that filming made this a TV spectacle rather than science, and asking, how can this be a model for anything when the prisoners take over the prison? Naturally, Riker and Haslam disagreed with his disagreement, pointing out that prisoners have de facto taken over some prisons, such as the Mays in Northern Ireland, which the Brits filled with IRA political prisoners, and the Robben Island prison, in which Nelson Mandela spent his endless years. Zimbardo called Riker and Haslam scientifically irresponsible and fraudulent. They pulled out all the stops by quoting Foucault, "Where there is coercive power, there is resistance." Let's calm down. Amid the controversies over Milgram and the SPE, two deeply vital things are indisputable. When pressured to conform and obey, a far higher percentage of perfectly normal people than most would predict succumb and do awful things. Contemporary work using a variant on the Milgram paradigm shows just following orders in action, where the pattern of neurobiological activation differs when the same act is carried out volitionally versus obediently. Nonetheless, there are always those who resist. This second finding is no surprise, given Hutus who died shielding Tutsi neighbors from Hutu death squads, Germans with every opportunity to look the other way who risked everything to save people from the Nazis, the informant who exposed Abu Ghraib. Some apples, even in the worst of barrels, do not go bad. Thus, what becomes vital is to understand the circumstances that push us toward actions we thought we were far better than, or that reveal strength we never suspected we had. Modulators of the pressures to conform and obey. The end of the previous chapter examined factors that lessen us-them dichotomizing. These included becoming aware of implicit automatic biases, becoming aware of our sensitivity to disgust, resentment, and envy, recognizing the multiplicity of us-them dichotomies that we harbor and emphasizing ones in which a them becomes an us. Contact with a them under the right circumstances, resisting essentialism, perspective-taking, and, most of all, individuating thems. Similar factors decrease the likelihood of people doing appalling things in the name of conformity or obedience. These include the nature of the authority or group pressing for conformity. Does the authority or authorities evoke veneration, identification, pants-wetting terror? Is the authority in close proximity? Milgram follow-ups showed that when the authority, i.e. the scientist, was in a different room, compliance decreased. Does the authority come cloaked in prestige? When the experiment was conducted in some nondescript warehouse in New Haven, instead of on the Yale campus, compliance declined. And as emphasized by Teufel in his writing, is the authority perceived as legitimate and stable? I'd more likely comply with, say, lifestyle advice issued by the Dalai Lama than by the head of Boko Haram. Similar issues of prestige, proximity, legitimacy, and stability influence whether people conform to a group. Obviously, groups of us's evoke more conformity than do groups of them's. Consider the invoking of us in Konrad Lorenz's attempt to justify becoming a Nazi. Practically all my friends and teachers did so, including my own father, who certainly was a kindly and humane man. With groups, issues of numbers come into play. How many other voices are urging you to join the cool kids? Recall how among chimps or two-year-old humans, one individual doing something three times does not evoke the conformity of three individuals doing the same act once each. Echoing this, Follow-up studies by Ash showed that conformity first kicks in when there are at least three people unanimously contradicting what the subject thinks, with maximum conformity first evoked by around half a dozen contradictors. But this is the artificial world of lab subjects judging the length of a line. In the real world, the conforming power of a lynch mob of six doesn't approach that of a mob of 1,000. What is being required and in what context? Two issues stand out. The first is the persuasive power of the incremental. You were okay shocking the guy with 225 volts, but not with 226? That's illogical. Come on, we're all boycotting their businesses. Let's shut them down. It's not like anyone patronizes them. Come on, we've shut down their businesses. Let's loot them. It's not like the stores are doing them any good. We rarely have a rational explanation for an intuitive sense that a line has been crossed on a continuum. What incrementalism does is put the potential resistor on the defensive, making the savagery seem like an issue of rationality rather than of morality. This represents an ironic inversion of our tendency to think in categories, to irrationally inflate the importance of an arbitrary boundary. The descent into savagery can be so incremental as to come with nothing but arbitrary boundaries, and our descent becomes